Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. This is the first episode of 2023. I'm thrilled to be back in New York. I was about to say Australia, but back in New York after traveling to Australia for the summer. It's good to be here. And I'm really excited to kick this year off with a topic that I have been so confused about. It's a very controversial topic. It's like the boogeyman in the room. The topic is saturated fat. Now, there is a lot of controversy regarding the effects of saturated fat on disease states such as atherosclerosis, stroke, and other neurodegenerative diseases. Now, here's the thing. There's studies that have suggested that high amounts of saturated fat in the diet may increase your risk of these diseases, while other research has indicated no association at all. There's some researchers who believe that a diet too high in saturated fat can lead to an increased production of cholesterol and inflammation, which are both implicated in the development of diseases such as strokes. But then there's other researchers who argue that saturated fat can be beneficial to brain health by providing essential fatty acids, reducing blood sugar levels, and improving overall cognition. So there's a lot of evidence on both sides, which is why I'm thrilled to have our special guest, Dr. Robert Lustig, here to talk to us. So we're going to be tackling this very important issue that affects us all. We're going to talk about what it is. What is saturated fat? What role does it play in causing atherosclerosis? So our discussion will cover the science behind saturated fat, its impact on health, as well as provide a better understanding of omega-3 fatty acids and their importance in health, especially brain health. For those of you who haven't heard of my guest today, let me give you a brief introduction. Dr. Robert Lustig, he's a professor of pediatric endocrinology at the University of California. He's a leading public health expert who has long been exposing the myths of modern medicine and the food industry. His passion is communicating how sugar and ultra-processed foods is fueling the chronic disease epidemic that we're all facing today. Obesity, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, heart disease, and so much more are caused, in Robert's view, by the foods that we're eating. So in this two-part episode, we will be discussing all of this. And remember, in today's episode, when we discuss saturated fat and omega-3 fatty acids, we are going to have an indication of what is driving these metabolic disease states from the view of saturated fat and omega-3 fatty acids. I hope you enjoy the episode. If you do, please go through, rate us on Apple iTunes. And if you feel like it, go and screenshot this, put it on your Instagram story, and I'll reshare you. I hope you enjoy this one. Let's dive in. So a very big misunderstanding, again, in this culture of health and nutrition is the topic around saturated fat. Now, when I speak openly about brain health and I talk about a stroke, if we think about a stroke, for example, it's an occlusion of blood in a vessel somewhere in the brain. That's really what we're talking about. So when I speak about things such as what can be blocking this, one thing that I have posed to the public is saturated fat. And every time I do that, I seem to get a whole range of comments coming through. So I'd love to get to the bottom of saturated fat, some of the misunderstandings, and is it bad for you or is it good for you?
The answer is yes. No, let me take it apart, if you will. Okay. As with everything in nutrition, it's complicated. Let's define saturated fat, because it turns out there's not one saturated fat, there's two. And so if you don't understand the difference between them, you're going to be unbelievably confused. So we have long chain fatty acids, 16 to 20, basically, carbons and they are all single bonds. That's saturated fat. But turns out some of those are even chain, and some of those are odd chain. So C16, 18, 20 are in one category. C15 and 17 are in another category. When we talk about saturated fat, we dump all of them together into one bucket. That's not correct. That's inappropriate. Turns out, red meat saturated fat is even chain, and dairy saturated fat is odd chain. And not just odd chain, but odd chain with a very specific phospholipid signature on the tail end of that fatty acid. And that odd chain saturated fat with that phospholipid signature has actually been shown to be protective against diabetes, heart disease, etc., against chronic disease. Dairy turns out to be good. Red meat is another story. So let's talk about red meat saturated fat, because that's what most people think of when they talk about saturated fat. The studies on red meat demonstrate a correlation between red meat consumption and cardiovascular disease. That's true. Now, if you look at the data carefully, and you have to look at it carefully, the hazard risk ratio for red meat consumption over 100 grams per day and cardiovascular disease has a hazard risk ratio of 1.25. So that means if you eat red meat, you know, at that level, you are 25% more likely to get a heart attack or diabetes. 25%. Now, the public health community has actually said 30% is sort of the threshold for worrying about it from a public health standpoint. So 25% is not 30%. So that's number one. Okay. So yes, there's a correlation, but it's not that big. Number two, and this is the important part. There's other stuff in red meat aside from saturated fat. There's heme, iron, which is an oxidative stress. There are trans fats. There are antibiotics. There are branched chain amino acids. And there is choline. Now, each of those have been shown to cause metabolic dysfunction all by themselves, and also in association with red meat, having nothing to do with saturated fat.
Mm.
So, turns out, heme is an oxidative stress all by itself, and guess what? That's what's in Impossible Burger, soy-like hemoglobin. It's still an oxidative stress, and that oxidative stress is going to cause metabolic dysfunction on its own. Branched-chain amino acids. Leucine, isoleucine, valine, found in corn-fed beef, chicken, fish, here in the United States. Other countries, less so, okay, because they don't have corn. You know, we do. And we feed our cows corn. What are they supposed to eat? They're supposed to eat grass, but they eat corn to fatten them up so they can actually be slaughtered early, increase cash flow. The point is that those branched-chain amino acids are going to be deamidated in the liver. The amino group is going to be taken off. They're going to form a branched chain organic acid, which is then going to be shunted to the mitochondria. The mitochondria become overwhelmed and are going to basically not be able to process all of that into ATP and carbon dioxide. And so the excess will be thrown off, will exit the mitochondria through a process known as the citrate shuttle. And then that citrate will then be the basis, the substrate for building up of fat in the liver called de novo lipogenesis. So branched chain amino acids drive de novo lipogenesis. De novo lipogenesis drives fatty liver, and fatty liver drives chronic metabolic disease. Antibiotics. So we have to give antibiotics to the cows because they're lying in their own manure on these concentrated animal feeding operations. And so, you know, to keep them alive, we give them antibiotics. Well, the antibiotics gets into the meat. We eat that, and then we change our microbiome and usually are killing off the fragile ones, which are a problem because they're the ones that are actually helping make those short-chain fatty acids. So inflammation. And finally, choline. So choline is actually known as vitamin B4. You need it. It is true. You need choline because you have to make acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter. You have to make phosphatidylcholine, which is part of ApoB100, which helps shuttle fats around the body. So you absolutely need choline, and you have to consume it because it's a vitamin. But it turns out excess choline will be metabolized by that bad microbiome into a compound called trimethylamine, or TMA, which then gets absorbed, goes to your liver, gets oxidized there to something called TMAO, trimethylamine oxide, which has been shown by Stanley Hazen and the Cleveland Clinic Group to be the stickiest substance produced in the body. And so where does it go after it's sticky? It lines your arteries and your liver and causes metabolic dysfunction by itself. In other words, red meat is a problem. It's not a huge problem, but it's a problem. And I'm not saying it's not a problem. It is a problem. But it's not because of the saturated fat. The data on even chain fatty acids and cardiovascular disease and diabetes demonstrate neutrality. Basically, they don't help, they don't hurt. They're not good, they're not bad. Odd chain fatty acids with that phospholipid signature, i.e. dairy, are actually good. So the notion that saturated fat is the bad guy has to be dispelled. Saturated fat is not the bad guy. Red meat is not great, but it's not because of the saturated fat.
Before we move further, I know you're loving the episode, but I have to talk about today's sponsor. So feeding your brain correctly is absolutely essential for optimal mental performance, as we've learned so far. Did you know that your brain cells require energy to work efficiently? Well, it's true. This energy actually comes from the mitochondria. So having efficient mitochondria is key to keeping your brain energized and functioning at its best. Luckily, there's a way to give your mitochondria a boost, and that's by consuming exogenous ketones. Exogenous ketones have been proven to not only increase mitochondrial biogenesis, but also improve the body's ability to burn fat more efficiently. So this means that taking these ketones, like the ones that I'm taking from HVMN, it's called Ketone IQ. By taking these as part of your daily routine, it can give you an edge on productivity and mental clarity throughout the day. For me personally, I've been supplementing with Ketone IQ from HVMN. It's made a huge difference in my cognitive ability. Last year, when I was talking about this product, I was mentioning that it did a lot for appetite suppressing. And while it's still doing this, I'm more confident on the fact that it's having a greater beneficial effect on my brain. And this product, I'm looking at it now, has fewer fillers and artificial ingredients than any other one that I've tried before. Plus, it's got a neutral flavor profile, so you can add it to anything without altering the taste too much. So if you guys want to check this out and you want to get your hands on a bottle of Ketone IQ, you can get 20% off. Just go to hvmn.com, type in Neuro20 when you go to the checkout, and it will automatically give you 20% off. I'll link everything below. That's Neuro20 at checkout. So then, I love that you said that. So why is it that we are having this misunderstanding around, let's talk about blood vessels, okay? Let's reframe this. Now, we know that the brain is one of, if not the most vascular rich organ in the body. We've got two main pumps that come out of the heart that feed the brain. We've got the vertebral arteries, we've got the carotid arteries, and then we have all these little branching off that goes into the brain. So we've got so much to take care of when it comes to the vessels of the brain. What causes the plaque buildup in these vessels, whether we're talking cardiovascular risk factors or even cerebral risk factors? Is it the saturated fat?
No, it's not the saturated fat.
Fantastic.
It's endothelial dysfunction. The endothelium is like those tight junctions that we talked about in the liver in the previous episode. So endothelium, those cells are supposed to basically attach to each other and basically form a barrier so that nothing gets through. But when the endothelium gets altered, then various fatty acid products coming through those as lipoproteins can be picked off and end up inside the subintimal layer. And that's what starts the foam cell process. And ultimately, that's what leads to the plaque. So keeping your endothelium intact and non-dysfunctional is essential. Well, it turns out the biggest driver of endothelial dysfunction is insulin. So when you become insulin resistant, you end up with endothelial dysfunction. In addition, we have these different species in our blood of lipoproteins. One's called LDL. One's called HDL. And then we have this other one called triglyceride, which is VLDL. So we have LDL, HDL, VLDL. Right? Wrong. I just said that's what we have, but in fact, LDL is really two species.
Yeah.
In the same way, in the same way we had two species before in the previous episode when we taped. Okay, we have two species of LDL, two species of insulin, two species of LDL. One's called large buoyant, one's called small dense, and they are not the same either. Large buoyant LDL are cardiovascularly neutral. Large buoyant are not protective, but they're not harmful to metabolic disease. Small dense, on the other hand, are easily oxidized because they're smaller, and because they're dense, they don't float. And so they can actually be caught in the endothelium dysfunction because they're not being carried through laminar flow because they sink. And so they are, because they're more easily oxidized and because they sink, they are the driver of that foam cell formation. So, large buoyant, small dense. When your liver makes VLDL, which is triglyceride, when it offloads, that's what increases small dense. So, it's that liver fat being exported out that ultimately serves as that driver. So the LDL from consuming dietary saturated fat, like red meat saturated fat, that raises your large buoyant. And by the way, the large buoyant is the target of statins. Well, yeah, but the large buoyant is not really the problem. And this is why the data on statin use for primary prevention of heart disease is virtually non-existent. Now, if you have already had a heart attack, you've already declared yourself, then statins are very good. And it's been shown that statins are very useful for secondary prevention because you've already declared yourself. But for primary prevention, what statins are doing is they're lowering the large buoyant, but the large buoyant is cardiovascularly neutral. And if you look at the data, in multiple meta-analyses now, because there are millions of people who've been on statins, the mean increase in survival with statin use for primary prevention is a total of 4 days. That's it. 4 days. And we know that statins are mitochondrial toxins.
Yeah.
They interfere with 3-hydroxymethylglutaryl-CoA reductase, which is a mitochondrial enzyme. And so it shouldn't be surprising then that statin use has a 20% increased risk for diabetes because your mitochondria are screwed. So this notion that we should be lowering LDL to reduce cardiovascular disease is actually kind of turned on its head. Now, there are people who absolutely need statins, and I'll be very honest with you, I'm one of them. My family has familial hypercholesterolemia. My grandfather on my father's side died when he was 44. My father had his first heart attack at 61. My mother's father had 4 heart attacks, the first one at age 38, and finally died of his 4th heart attack at age 72. I have extremely high cholesterol, LDL cholesterol in the 300s, and my sister does as well. And we're both on, she's now on PCSK9 inhibitors. I'm still on statins. Point is, we need to be, because we have genetic reasons for being on statins. So statins probably are the reason I'm still sitting here talking to you. And so if you have a problem with your LDL, you know, because of a genetic problem, then statins are very good. And I'm not saying that you should just go off statins. But what I would say is that of every 5 people who are on statins in the world, probably 4 of those 5 don't need them.
So then do you find it a problem when you go and get your labs and it comes back with just the basic and generic LDL, HDL, and your GP says, well, LDL is the quote-unquote bad cholesterol, and we need to keep this under 70.
Well, I go to a cardiologist who knows a little better.
Yeah.
Yeah. My cardiologist is phenomenal, you know, and as a collaborator at UCSF. So, you know, I know a little bit more and know when my doctors are, you know, doing the right thing. Yeah. The fact of the matter is most GPs don't understand this, and they're just reading the numbers off the side of the lab slip. Oh, you know, your LDL is over 100, you know, you need a statin according to the guidelines. You know, well, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. And, you know, this is what we're trying to fight. You know, the concept that everyone needs a medicine is, you know, just ridiculous. You know, it needs to be turned on its head.
What's your stance on ApoB? And if you would like to venture down that field by explaining what ApoB is and its relation to atherosclerosis?
So apolipoprotein B100, or ApoB, is the protein on the surface of both LDL and triglycerides. So because LDL has its own cardiovascular risk, as we talked about, the small dents, and because triglycerides, or VLDL, have their own cardiovascular risk, turns out measuring apolipoprotein B measures both at the same time. Measures both LDL and triglyceride. And so people have started to use ApoB as a better risk assessment for heart disease than either LDL or HDL or triglyceride alone. So a lot of people are suggesting ApoB as a better cardiovascular marker. Peter Attia just released his Ask Me Anything and, you know, basically, you know, swears by ApoB. I am an advisor for Levels Health, which is a continuous glucose monitoring organization, company that helps you keep your blood glucose stable in order to keep your insulin stable in order to improve metabolic health. And we have just released a set of 5 labs that are conglomerated together, and ApoB is one of them. For just that reason. So I'm a fan of ApoB. But the point is that ApoB is only helpful when you know which of the species within ApoB is actually the problem. And that's why we have the other 4 labs to help us distinguish that.
Yeah. So then I hope that the people listening to this can kind of understand why people such as yourself is so adamant about understanding more than just what it, you know, your doctor is putting out there. Because I can't tell you how many times even my parents are like, oh, the doctor said I've got high cholesterol. I'm like, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? It turns out that they don't even test. I had a hard time, which I'm really open about on this. I had an actual argument with my parents' GP because she wouldn't order an LP little A for my father, and I had no idea why. So
LP little A is a real thing, and yeah. LP little A is not really picked up in any of the other tests. And Peter suggests that LP little A is a, you know, should be a diagnostic parameter, and you know, likely in the future we will include that as well. Yeah. It's sort of a low level chronic inflammatory process within the vessels. So I'm not against LP little A, or measuring it. I think that, you know, we sort of have to sort out the big things before we get to the little things. You know, I think there's a gradation of concern. And I would put LP little A sort of, you know, lower down than the others, but not because it's not there.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly answered my questions around saturated fat and how this is a misconception when it comes to an occlusion of a blood vessel. In fact, it is the endothelial lining, which can, you know, be dysfunctional. And then that can obviously cause it to become weak and cause the buildup of this plaque.
High blood pressure will cause that endothelial dysfunction. So you have to deal with that. You know, high insulin will cause it as well. Uric acid. You know, there are all sorts of things that will ultimately lead to endothelial dysfunction. And that will then start the foam sole formation process. And yes, it is true that lipids end up in there. But it's not because the lipids caused it. It's because the lipids ended up in there because the endothelium was not intact.
I love that. I've got one more question and then we'll let you go. And it's around omega-3 fatty acids, for or against, and why?
Omega-3 fatty acids are essential fatty acids. You have to consume them. Your body cannot make them. And there are three omega-3 fatty acids. One's called ALA, and it's found in produce. It's found in flax at very high levels. It's found in other green vegetables. So you can get ALA from, being a vegan. You can get ALA. The other two are called EPA, which stands for eicosapentaenoic acid, and DHA or dexahexaenoic acid. EPA and DHA are necessary for neuronal membranes. They help neurons be flexible in terms of their membranes. They improve membrane fluidity, and so they are important for neuronal structure, function, and neurotransmission. You can only get EPA and DHA from marine life, from seafood, but not any old seafood. You have to get them from wild seafood, not farmed fish, but wild fish. Why? Well, it turns out the fish don't make the omega-3s. The fish eat the omega-3s. So what does make the omega-3s? The algae. The algae makes the omega-3s. The fish eat the algae. We eat the fish. We get our omega-3s third hand. Well, farmed fish do not eat algae. Farmed fish eat corn. And corn is very high in omega-6s. Omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, which the goal is to try to reduce inflammation, not promote it. So, omega-3s are essential for normal neurotransmission. But here's the key. Only EPA and DHA are in the brain. ALA is important for cardiovascular protection, but it does not help the brain. So people who are vegans will get their ALA, but they won't necessarily get their EPA or DHA. And so those people really, really need to consider taking EPA or DHA supplementation in the form of fish oil. But they have to get wild fish oil, not farmed fish oil. And so when you look at the supplement bottle, you better look at the side and see whether or not it was wild fish. And if it was wild fish, it will say so. If it doesn't say anything, likely it was farmed fish. So getting EPA supplementation or DHA supplementation is not as easy as it sounds, but it really is essential for cognitive benefits, for prevention of Alzheimer's disease, for prevention of depression, prevention of other neurobehavioral disorders. Omega-3s are essential fatty acids, and they are very low in our diet. We have to up our game, up our consumption of them. And that means eating wild fish. Problem is, the wild fish is disappearing from the oceans. And, this is a problem.
This is a big problem. I just want to thank you for coming on the Neuro Experience podcast. And you've got a wonderful book, Metabolical. I was just thinking of something else. I was thinking of Casey's Metabolical that she had.
Yes.
I was like, oh my gosh. Metabolical, your book, we're going to link that below. I know that you are on Twitter and on Instagram, so we're going to be pushing this out through that, and we're going to link everything below. And it was just so nice to have this conversation with you, Robert.
That's been my pleasure, Louisa. Anything I can do in the future, let me know.
I'll just stop this.